Hey, Rashi, have you been following the presidential election at all?
Yeah, I'm sick of everybody. I just am going to run myself. Here, I'm starting to make campaign buttons.
Oh, yeah? What's your campaign slogan?
Vote for Rashi.
That sounds good.
Yeah. Underneath it, very, very tiny, it says the rest of them just suck.
I can't argue with it. Oh, you got my vote.
Awesome.
Hi, this is Paul Dini.
This is Misty Lee, and we have a special guest tonight.
I'm not a special guest. I'm always here.
He's here every night.
But you make the podcast more beautiful every time you're on.
Oh,
actually,
gosh.
We're so pleased to have him with us today. We open the windows so the world can see him, and we're recording at night. So
and he is.
Really,
you have not. You have
oh,
not
hello.
Mentioned
him. it's Mr. Mark Evanier.
Yay!
Fabled and legendary.
And we are thrilled to have him here.
Yes.
He asked right before we started, so do we know what we're talking about tonight? And I said, I have a list, so I can make it easy on you, or you can make it hard on yourself.
Whatever you'd like, fine.
So do you want to just throw into it? We're waiting for a pizza, by the way, so the doorbell may ring.
Yes, it will show up the minute I am getting near a punchline.
Yes.
I will be telling the best story of this entire podcast, and just as I'm approaching the punchline, we will hear a doorbell, and the dogs will begin barking feverishly.
And yes. Someone, hopefully there will be a naked girl behind the door, which is actually the first thing I want to ask you about.
Oh.
Right. Do you know what I'm going to ask you about?
No.
Naked
soup,
girls
soup
on
sales.
Yes.
Oh.
Good guess.
All right.
I thought it was naked girl pizza delivery or something.
Oh, well, do you have a naked girl pizza delivery story?
I could make one up.
No. I'd rather you tell the soupy sales story.
Which soupy sales story am I telling?
Yes. All of them.
Exactly. All of them.
His entire life.
I was an enormous fan of soupy sales when I was a small lad. I loved watching the Soupy Sales show. He was on Channel 7 in Los Angeles, KBC, for a couple of years.
Now, was he always national? Did he start national?
No, he started in Detroit.
That's what I thought.
With a local show. And then he moved out here with a local show. And then they started syndicating that local show to some of the ABC affiliates.
Okay.
And then finally, he didn't really go national. Well, he never went completely national. He was never on every place in the country. Until they syndicated a show he did in the late 70s. But he was on in Los Angeles. He did do a show that was a daytime. He started with a show called Lunch with Soupy Sales, which was on Saturdays. And then for a while he had a daytime show Monday through Friday. And he would also have, and then they overlapped. There was a point when he was actually on the air an hour on Saturdays and half an hour Monday through Friday.
Wow. Huh.
And then at one point, he also had a primetime show, which ran on some ABC affiliates and not others.
Okay.
That was the famous show where Frank Sinatra came on and got hit with a pie.
Oh, yeah.
And then later on, Sinatra did another thing with him on the New York show with Trini Lopez and Sammy Davis. But I used to watch the Soupy Sales show, and he would do it without a studio audience. It was him and a man named Clyde Adler, who played White Fang, Black Tooth, Pookie, Hippie, and all the guys at the door.
Okay.
And the crew would laugh at that show. And it was a point in my life when I wanted nothing more than to be part of Soupy's crew. I didn't want to be part of the show other than I wanted to be on the set, being one of those people you heard off camera laughing at Soupy and such. And I just loved his show. Around 1978 or 79, I may be off a year on this, I was doing a show for Sid and Marty Krofft. We were taping... It's one of the many variety shows I did for them, starring people who didn't speak English very well.
Oh, gosh.
And I'm walking down. We were at KTLA, the KTLA lot, where a lot of shows are taped that are not on KTLA. It's mostly a rental studio, although
okay.
KTLA broadcast out of there. And I'm walking down the lot, through the lot, and I ran into a man named Perry Cross, who I knew from another show I'd worked on, a producer. And I said, "Oh, Evanier, how you doing? What are you working on?" I told him about the show I was doing. And then I said, "So what are you working on, Perry?" And he said, "I'm working on the Soupy Sales Show." And I said, "What Soupy Sales Show?"
Exactly, yeah.
He took me by the wrist and he led me 5 steps through the door we were standing in front of into a studio. And we're suddenly on the set of a Soupy Sales Show. And he said, "This Soupy Sales Show." Soupy was doing a new syndicated show. And He was taped. They had not been announced. I had not heard about it. They were taping it there. Apparently, they've been taping there for 2 or 3 weeks.
Wow.
And I did not know that I was walking past the Soupy Sales Show
when
I went
day.
To my office. And from that point on, I spent very little time on the set of my own show and all my time over being one of the people laughing on Soupy's set. Now, here's an interesting thing that as you know, my life is full of incredible coincidences.
Yes, I do.
Soupy had a select group of devout fans that he would allow onto the set.
Mm-hmm.
There was no studio audience, but he had the crew, and then there were certain people who were invited to come to the set, and I became one of those people. Oh. And there were just these guys kind of milling around, strangers, kids, mostly young guys.
Mm-hmm.
I did not meet him at the time, but one of those people was Earl Kress.
Oh my God.
I did not meet him at that time, but one of those people was Stuart Shostak.
Oh my gosh.
People who became two of my closest friends
in
years,
the whole world,
years later.
Yeah.
We were all hanging out on the set of Soupy's show at the same time without meeting one another.
And two guys who got to see the giant W, or was it just Earl?
Just Earl.
Okay. But
anyway.
That bastard.
So
he said with distinction, just Earl.
I asked Perry Cross that day who was doing White Fang.
Mm-hmm.
Because when Soupy did his show in Detroit, he had tapped a former film editor there named Clyde Adler, to be the guy who worked with him on camera. And
okay.
then they brought Clyde out, and Clyde was the L.A. White Fang, Black Tooth, Pookie, Hippie. Then when the show went back to New York after that, and Soupy did the show out of, I think it was WNEW in New York, they had a man named Frank Nastasi. Clyde decided he didn't want to live in New York. He wanted to go back to Detroit. He went back to Detroit. And a fan named Frank Nastasi did it. Now, Earl first learned of Frank Nastasi. He was first familiar with the Frank Nastasi shows, and I was first familiar with the White. So Earl and I, we were united in our love for Soupy, but we were divided by our preference for who was White Fang.
Of course.
To me,
it was
always be Clyde Adler. So I said to Perry, so now tell me, who's playing White Fang and Black Tooth and Pookie and Hippie? And just then a man walks past. He says, Clyde, come over here. And he introduces me to Clyde Adler.
Wow.
And I was more excited to meet Clyde Adler than I was to meet Soupy Sales.
Yeah.
The producer of the show I was doing for the Crofts was a lady named Bonnie Dorr,
okay.
who had worked in television in Detroit and knew Clyde from there. And I knew that because she told me that she knew Clyde Adler. And I said, Clyde, you remember Bonnie Dorr? He said, oh, I love Bonnie. I said, well, you want to go to lunch with her? Because we're here. He goes, great. Can we go to lunch today? I said, sure. And so we arranged things. So I went to Bonnie's office and I said, we're going to lunch today with someone. She says, who are we going to? I said, I'm not going to tell you. We'll surprise you. We're going to lunch with someone. So around 12:30, I'm in the office with Bonnie. We're working on the script. We're working on the breakdown and things like that. And the intercom buzzes, and this receptionist says, there's a call for Mark here. So I put it on the speakerphone. I said, hello. And I heard on the speakerphone, rah, rah, rah. And I said, oh, Clyde, you ready to go to lunch? Yeah. You want to go to the Denny's across the street? You want to go to the Brown Derby? And we were doing. I was doing Soupy there. Anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
So we went to lunch. We had a great time. Now, I just loved Clyde. He was just. I love Soupy, but I for some reason I always. You know, I'm one of those people who like Bud Abbott more than Lou Costello.
Sure.
I always like the straight man. I always like the person who supports. I always see that what they do that's so difficult that doesn't get the accolades.
Yeah.
Clyde Adler was working as hard as Soupy and making Soupy funny, but people didn't appreciate it, possibly because they never saw him.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
Anyway, so I would hang around that set. Now, unfortunately, I was there the day Clyde had his heart attack.
Oh.
And they took him out on a stretcher, and I was just, we were all standing around crying on that.
Yeah.
But he recovered. He went back to Detroit and, you know, now, flash forward a few years, about 82 or 83, I was producing a special for ABC on the history of children's television on ABC. This is, they, I remember being called and they said, Mark, we have the easiest job you'll ever have in your life for you. And I did it mostly from memory and things
wow.
like that. So we had to find clips of things. And I wanted, of course, to include not only a clip of Soupy Sales, but you had a clip of Soupy Sales, you had to have a clip of him getting hit with a pie.
Of course.
That meant you had to have White Fang or the guy at the door, in other words, and I wanted Clyde Adler.
Sure.
So I had heard that most of Soupy Sales shows were destroyed, that they were lost. But I went down this, and we were doing this on the ABC lot. I was working for ABC. This was an ABC in-house production. So I went to the film vaults at the ABC studio, and I went to this beleaguered lady who was in charge of the film vault, and I said, I need some clips of Soupy Sales. And mm-hmm. she got annoyed with me. It was like, what do you mean that we don't have any clips of Soupy Sales? Everybody comes in here and wants clips of the Soupy Sales show. I'm so sick of people coming in. And she was like, I felt like bad. Like I was the 800th person that hour to call and ask for clips of the Soupy Sales show, whatever it was.
And I'm she sure starts she gets telling asked me, like, we once don't every 5 years.
Have, they're all lost. Somebody threw them away. We have no kinescopes. We have no tapes. We have no films of the Soupy Sales show. Will you people please stop bothering me? And I said, I just asked the once. She goes, please stop bothering me.
Wow.
So I said, okay. So I guess, you know, we have to look someplace else. I walk out. I walk, take 2 steps down the hall. I had a thought. And I was afraid to go back in there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I had
that
to.
That lady was
I
mean.
I came back and I said, excuse me. Forgive me for asking. Just indulge me for 30 seconds. You tell me you have no clips of the Soupy Sales show. She says, right. For years, people have asked me, I don't have any. I said, have you tried looking for Lunch with Soupy Sales?
Mm-hmm.
She goes, Lunch with Soupy Sales? I said, look under L. She goes to this little card file, goes, oh yeah, we got about 600 hours of that.
Oh my God.
Not 600, yeah. It was more like 100 hours.
Yeah.
They had,
it was more than
were.
Zero.
Yeah. Yeah. The point is, they've been sitting there and everybody been looking under S instead of under L. So we get the clip. I get to watch all these kinescopes. I watched like 20 hours of kinescopes of Soupy Sales shows.
Yeah. Because it was impossible to find a good clip, in order to pick out the
30-second clip.
Sure. You had to.
And
it's research.
What I needed was a very bad joke, and then Soupy gets hit with a pie. And I narrowed it down to about, 400 possibilities.
Yeah.
So I finally picked the clip. Now we got a release from Soupy. We had to pay him some money to let us use the clip. And we needed a release from Clyde Adler. And we didn't have a phone number for Clyde Adler.
Oh.
Soupy didn't have a contact information. He says, no, I don't know how to reach him. Soupy's manager did not have a contact for Clyde Adler. And we're looking. We can't reach Clyde Adler. We tried the phone book in Detroit, and it was not there. So I'm sitting in my office, and the lady who was in charge of the legal clearances comes to me and says, have you got the clearance from Clyde Adler yet? I said, no, we haven't. She says, you've got till 5 o'clock today.
Oh, no.
Or we have to cut him out and use another clip. I said, we can't use another clip. We got to have him Soupy hit with a pie. And the only person who hit him with pies in these shows was Clyde. And you got to have the setup, so Clyde has to have a line before you can hit him with a pie. She says, well, I'm sorry. We cannot use Clyde Adler's likeness on this show unless you have a clearance from him. So I'm sitting there in my office at the ABC studios feeling like just, this is awful. This is terrible. We've been trying for 3 weeks to find Clyde Adler. We can't find him. I've got about an hour to find him. And suddenly I look down, and there's an inter-office phone directory on my desk. It's been there the whole time. And it lists all the ABC facilities. And I flipped to the tab that said Detroit, and the first listing was Adler Clyde.
Oh, my God.
I dialed the 3-digit extension that put me through to Detroit. It rang twice, and somebody answered the phone and went, bleh.
Oh, my God.
It was Clyde Adler.
It's that simple.
His number was on my desk for 3 weeks right in front of me.
Unbelievable. Now, what was he doing in Detroit?
He was back in the film editing department.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But he was the first listing in the book. It was alphabetical.
Yeah, of course he was.
It was Adler Clyde. There it was, the first listing right there.
Unbelievable.
And so we got to use the clip of him.
Now, you mentioned that Clyde Adler was one of the only people to hit Soupy with a pie, but that's not true.
I know it isn't. I got to hit Soupy with a pie, yes.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
And I would like to hear that story.
On the set of this syndicated Soupy Sales show, I was watching them. They were doing this thing. Clyde was a very good pie hurler. And
that's a unique talent. Thank God he hooked up with Soupy.
Yes. Well, he'd learned.
Did he know that he was good at this before he worked
with
Soupy?
No, he'd learned how to do it.
Oh, he honed this talent.
He'd thrown 20,000 of them at the guy by then. So,
true.
You know, you got to learn something. There's a learning curve on this.
That's hysterical. And you know what? Soupy, I would like to become good at this.
Well, okay. I'm sure Paul would be glad to be your subject.
What?
They had these shaving.
Yeah, where you been?
They had these shaving cream pies. They would have real.
Oh, they weren't even whipped cream?
No. They had real pie shells, the kind you'd buy in the market. And they would put them in the oven or in a microwave to make them more brittle. Because
mm-hmm.
the premise is the pie shell has to explode on impact. And then they would load them with, and I learned that you have to use non-menthol shaving cream. It's like the cheapest shaving cream you can buy, literally. It has nothing in it but soap.
Okay.
Menthol
would burn your eyes.
Menthol would burn your eyes.
Yeah.
Or any sort of additives. You use the cheapest thing, and you put it in, you know, less than 2 minutes before you have to hurl it, because it will lower down.
Okay.
So if Clyde was hitting Soupy with, you know, 10 pies and a sketch, people would be filling the pie shells, the prop guys would be filling the pie shells while the bit was going on, so they'd have it ready the minute he could ready to throw it.
It would
really time this. And then...
That's right, because it was all live.
And then the most important thing is that, and the key thing was that some guy had to hit the sound effects button and have the rifle shot sound effect hit at exactly that moment live.
Oh my gosh.
So because a pie, hitting someone with a pie is nothing if you don't have the sound of a bullet ricochet at the same time.
That's what that is. That
yes, that's okay. Right. So they're doing a thing, a sketch, and Soupy is dressed in a tuxedo with the tails, and he's conducting the 1812 overture being performed by an off-camera, a non-existent orchestra. And every time they come to the cannon roar, he's hit with a pie.
Of course.
Da, 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 boom, da, 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 boom. Da, da, da.
Nice.
And Clyde was hurling the pies. And he was like one after another. It was about, and there's like a chain of prop guys filling the shells
as they
go to him and passing them to him. And it was out like a science. It was really fascinating to see. It was more interesting than sketch if you could see the wide shot and see these men filling the pie shells.
Did they rehearse this? They must have.
I don't think they rehearsed it with pies.
Wow.
I think they didn't need to. Well, because this was on tape.
Okay.
The show was on tape, so they could have done it over and over again if they had to.
Okay.
But you don't want to do that because then you got to clean
Makeup
Soupy up
and
stuff.
Yeah.
Well, but the thing is, the shaving cream, the reason for the shaving cream is it cleans up very fast.
Okay.
And they would just suck it up with a wet-dry vac, one of those wet-dry vacuum cleaners,
uh-huh.
and just they'd run it over, you know, Soupy would towel off his face, and then they'd run the thing over his shirt. And the wall behind him, and the pie would be gone. The shaving cream would just disappear.
I guess it wouldn't really leave wet spots on him either.
No.
Now sometimes
that's
in slapstick
brilliant.
Movies,
while they're hurling the pies,
yeah.
Clyde sees me standing there, and he signals me to come on over, and he puts a pie on my hand, and he spots my hand as I hurled the pie into the face of Soupy Sale.
Wow. Ah.
Anyway,
awesome.
And that was like my, and when I told years later, when I told Earl and Stu that, they went, ooh, we never got to hit Soupy with pies.
Because they were on the wrong side of the white
They weren't there fence. That day, and they weren't as close to Clyde as I was.
There you go. Yeah. See, they liked the other guy.
Yeah, I have some perks for that, but yeah. So anyway, now the last thing here that I should mention, I wrote an article about Soupy years ago for the Comics Buyer's Guide about my relationship with him. And I told the story I just told you, and I mentioned that I also knew the director of the Soupy Sale show. I'd worked with him on another show too, and I wrote down that the director was Lou Horvitz.
Okay.
It wasn't. It was Lou Tedesco. I just had a brain fart. I typed the wrong name. I meant Lou Tedesco. I typed Lou Horvitz.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, Lou Horvitz was an animation guy, yeah?
No, Lou Horvitz was the guy who usually directed the Academy Awards, the Emmys, things like that.
Okay.
Lou Tedesco was a guy who directed an awful lot of shows like game shows, and he was Soupy's director, and he directed a lot of live shows. Both wonderful men. I never worked with Lou Horvitz. I worked with Lou Tedesco, but I typed Lou Horvitz.
Okay. Mm.
Years later, I get this call from a guy who's ghostwriting Soupy's autobiography. And he says, I found your article online, or found a copy of it. May I quote from it in Soupy's autobiography? I said, Well, of course you can quote Soupy's, you know, of course. Be my guest. It's Soupy Sales. So I got invited. The book was published. I got invited to a signing Soupy was doing of it. Okay, and now, because the punchline is coming up on this story, the pizza is arriving.
Oh, my God. It's just, you know, if you smoked, it'd be when you light a cigarette.
That's right.
You know?
Okay.
Or if you don't, it's whenever you go to the bathroom, food comes.
They gave me a copy of the book, and Soupy signed it to me, and I looked at the book, and they reprinted the entire article,
uh-oh.
Including getting the name of the director wrong.
Oops.
They printed my... So it's in Soupy's autobiography. So tomorrow, if somebody was having an argument over, well, who directed that show? They'd go, well, let's consult Soupy's autobiography.
Oh,
he would
God.
Know. And it's wrong in his book because of me.
Oh, no, that poor man.
Yeah.
Poor Lou Tedesco.
Yes.
So Lou Tedesco, we're sorry.
Yes.
Is he still around?
I don't know.
He hates you.
That's probably does, yeah.
Well, at least we got it right on here.
Yes. It's the only thing we have right on here, but it's right.
Yes.
Anyway, exactly. So that's my Soupy Sales story.
Wow.
And I've seen Soupy once or twice since then. I saw him before he passed away a couple times.
Uh-huh.
He was not in good health the last 5-10 years of his life. He had an accident Oh. They never recovered from
it. What happened to him?
He fell down a flight of stairs.
You would think that he would jump up and everyone would laugh.
Yeah, you'd think that, wouldn't you?
But not so much.
He had injured himself, and he never quite recovered from that fall.
So Soupy was a total phenomenon at the time he was on the air, but was he the only one doing that kind
of
thing?
Soupy was one of the most plagiarized, because he tended to borrow from other people too, but every city in this country at some point had someone doing the Soupy Sales show.
Really?
Yeah, it's the same way every radio station, every radio market in this country at one point or another had at least one team doing Bob and Ray.
Hmm.
And every local station would have a guy basically replicating the Soupy Sales show to some extent. In L.A., when Soupy was on Channel 7 here, Channel 9 for a brief time had a fellow named Bill Holly who did the Soupy Sales show. I don't know why he wasn't sued, or maybe they threatened him, but he was doing a show that looked exactly like Soupy's. He had dog hands that reached into frame and threw pies at him. He had guys at the door. He danced like Soupy. It was a phenomenal thing. Because what Soupy had done was he had invented a very low-budget show. One of the things that did away with local kids' show hosts, apart from the problem with doing commercials and the problem with the fact that local television in general atrophied in the late 60s, was that people don't want to do cheap shows anymore. They look cheap. America, the public got kind of hip to the fact that, you know, sometimes the show is just one guy standing in front of an empty stage and mm-hmm. something. And
Francine Dancer.
There's always a feeling you need production values of some sort in a show.
Mm-hmm.
So one guy on camera with a guy off stage seemed kind of chintzy, even if it was Soupy. I mean, his personality overcame that, but not everybody could.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that's one of the reasons local shows went away. Most of the kid show hosts couldn't compete with the cartoons for being interesting.
Okay.
Well, that kind of ties in with the question I wanted to ask. A question I wanted to ask earlier is, you look around at children's entertainment now, and it's been largely marginalized to cable and to syndication and things and its own networks. And yet there is no Soupy Sales type personality. There seems to be this rabid mania to capture youth and the theory that only kids will respond to kids. And that so whenever you see like a Disney show, it's kids, you know, young kids doing in a sitcom format, goofing around or being, you know, in these goofy scenarios. There is no there is no TV show host like a Soupy Sales, like a guy between 35 and 45. Pee Wee Herman being the sole exception because he was around before then and he kind of came into that niche because he was a parody of it. And it just seems like in talking to network people and, you know, we don't want that. Kids only respond to kids. Do you believe that?
Well, I think they think kids only respond to cartoons. And cartoons financially are probably easier to do. They have more of a long shelf life. Uh-huh. You can rerun them over and over again. You can sell them overseas.
That was what I was going to ask you.
You couldn't sell a local kid show host generally outside his market.
Sure.
But the point is, you know, the main thing I think that did away with kid show hosts is the same thing that did away with the afternoon movie in most marketplaces hosted locally. There's very few local shows produced anywhere. Even in Los Angeles, which you think is a major market, does Channel 13 produce one show in-house besides the news?
No.
I think Channel 5 has one or two besides the news. I mean, basically these local stations do the news and they have no other facilities even to produce television anymore.
Yeah, just occasionally like
there's
a
no horror
show.
Movie hosts either.
No. Oh.
You know, there's no local public affairs shows in most of these marketplaces.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a lot of reasons why kids show hosts went away, but I think the number one reason was that local stations simply stopped producing their own shows. It became more effective to buy off-network reruns or syndicated offerings.
Mm-hmm. I remember that was a factor in like the mid to late 80s when suddenly Disney announced they were getting into the kids business with the Disney Afternoon.
Yeah.
And there were local markets like up in Oakland and places like that, because I was living and working up in San Francisco, where you could still watch afternoon Popeye, you know, shows or Three Stooges or something like that. And then Disney moved in and said, no, no, we'll take over that entire block with whatever it was, 90 minutes of programming, you know, brand new shows with the Disney characters. And that obliterated the last traces of that, I remember at the time.
So speaking of kids, I want to go back to when you were a kid, Mark.
Okay, I was a kid.
not kid, but high school kid. Because we were talking the other day, you had two extremely fascinating stories. One was a coincidence about someone you went to high school with, and then it came into your life later in an emergency room. And the other one was your high school reunion.
Oh,
so okay. Which one would you like to tell first?
My father was a very lovely man. And this is the story of his heart attack.
Hilarious,
yes,
right?
Yes, good comedy. This was about 1982 or something like that, around there.
Mm-hmm.
My mother was working at the time during the day, part-time. So he was retired, he was at home. And one day I'm getting out of the shower about 10:30 in the morning, and the phone rings, and I pick it up, and he says, I think I'm having a heart attack. It's my father calling me. And he says, come over and take me to the hospital. And I said, let's call an ambulance. He said, no, no ambulance.
Why?
His father had died in an ambulance.
Oh.
His father was stricken in a synagogue on one of the Jewish holidays, one of the high holy days.
Okay.
And would not get into the ambulance because you're not supposed to ride
in a
vehicle. On a, mm-hmm. And the rabbi said, you know, Isaac, get in there. And he wouldn't do it. And finally he passed out, and the rabbis carried him into the ambulance. It was too late. So that's how my father's father passed away.
Well, then it makes sense.
So my father just had this, he didn't want to ride on an ambulance.
Yeah.
So I set the world record for drying, dressing, and driving. And I zoom over to my father's house. It's only a 15-minute ride. I think I made it in 6. And my father's almost passed out. I got him into the car. I zoomed down to the hospital. Driving, you know,
way too fast.
Way too fast. Yes.
Yes.
And I get him in. I take him into the hospital, and there is this little Filipino man doing triage, deciding who's seen in what order.
Oh boy!
And I said, ran up to him, and I said, "This man's having a heart attack. Take him in right now." And the little man says, "Oh, fill out the form and sit down. You have to go by procedure." I have in my life threatened violence about 3 times. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be 60. So on an average of every 20 years, I threaten somebody. And this was one of the few. Now, I said to the little Filipino man, I pointed to my father, I said, either he's seeing a doctor in 1 minute or you're seeing one in 2. And the little man said, oh, you sit down, please sit down. And just then there was a doctor who was leaving the hospital. He was had been on the night shift, an emergency room doctor, and he was leaving to go home after, you know, a long night on the job. And he sees what's going on, and he comes over, and he says, take Mr. Evanier's father into examining room 2. I will see him myself.
How the hell do you know who you were?
That's what I said to myself.
Alrighty then.
I said, hold it. I didn't, you know, how did he know my name?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I grabbed one of the nurses, and I said, who was that doctor who just took my father into
who
the
room? Who was that masked man?
Yes, exactly. Because my father, the minute this doctor said it, bang, my father was in the emergency room in 30 seconds.
Nice.
In an examining room. And the nurse said, that's Dr. Shockett. Huh. I said, Dr. Neil Shockett? She says, yes, you know him? I said, yes, I went to high school with him.
Oh, my God.
He was one of my best friends from high school.
Wow.
Nice.
And I didn't even know he'd become a doctor, let alone
he was
working
there. And you didn't
even
recognize him?
And I'm not sure I would have recognized him in the lab coat. He was wearing the white lab coat.
Sure, sure.
And I never saw
him. Well, and you weren't thinking about Neil Shockett. You were thinking about your dad having a heart attack.
But I might have at best said, gee, that guy looks familiar. But anyway. So they took care of my father and treated him, and my father survived that heart attack. Unfortunately, did not survive a later one.
Oh,
but,
sorry.
But so I'm walking Neil to the car, his car, about an hour and a half later. He stayed. He treated my father, and he picked out the doctor to hand him off to to take care of that.
Well, he sounds like a healthy guy.
Yeah. So I'm and it's interesting. Neil is a in hospitals they promote you out of the emergency room to other executive positions.
Sure.
He refused to be promoted because he felt that being in the emergency room was doctoring. That was what he became a doctor to do, was to have somebody walk in bleeding or sick and to send them out Better.
Better.
Yeah.
Wow, what a nice
So, I was walking to the car. I said, Neil, I don't know how to thank you. I thanked about 107 times. He said, there's two things you can do for me. He said, you can answer two questions for me, he said. I said, go ahead. He said, do you write comic books? I said, yes.
Question one down.
He said, Scooby-Doo comic books? I said, yes. And I realized why he asked this. When I was working for Gold Key Comics, there were no credits on the books I did.
Okay.
And in an issue of Scooby-Doo, I named a character Neil Shockett.
Nice!
And I also named several other characters in that after guys in high school. Mm-hmm. And someone had given that comic to Neil, said, look, there's a character named after you. And he looked at this thing, and he saw the other names of guys in his class. And he thought, who could have done this? And he thought, must be Evanier.
Nice.
Because he figured I would have become a comic book writer because he knew I had lots of comic books.
Yeah, yeah.
So to this day, every so often, I stick Neil Shockett in a comic book story just as a little inside thing. It's a good name, Neil Shockett. You can feel free to use it in one of your stories.
Okay.
Anyway.
I might have. Hopefully we won't be in the emergency.
So there are two questions. What was the other one? He said, did you ever nail that cheerleader you were dating?
Oh, my God.
So
Neil Shockett's nosy Neil Shockett.
Well, you know, I think there's every guy in the world would want to know the answer to that question about somebody in his. We all want to know who nailed the cheerleader.
Well, that's fair.
So,
and in this case, it was Mark Evanier.
That's the emergency room story.
Now the high school reunion.
High school reunion story. Okay, this is a very bizarre thing. I have this friend. I'll call him George.
Okay.
Because that's his name.
Right.
And George has more money than everyone in this room collectively, plus everyone listening to this podcast collectively, will ever have.
Yes.
George has
like 20 bucks.
George has money because George got into the very important primal line of work that always pays off, which is selling people pictures of other people having sex.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, nice.
And it's very lucrative. So, and I hear from George every 4 or 5 years. He calls me up, what are you doing? Hey, let's get together for lunch and things like that. We talk, things like that. Nice, very nice fellow. So we got invited to our high school reunion. Now, my high school reunion, we had a 10-year reunion that took place 12 years after we got out of high school. And we had a 20-year reunion, which took place 23 years after we got out of high school, which is the kind of class we had.
Yeah. Right.
But this is the 23. The 10-year was a tiny one. Mm-hmm. And the 20-year reunion held 23 years later was a big one.
Okay.
So George got excited about the 20-year reunion because somehow he was too shy in high school to ever ask a girl out.
Okay.
And he's still very shy, but he figures, well, I've got enough money now. Maybe someone will go out with me. He had it somehow in his head that all the same girls that we had in our class would be there at the reunion, that they'd all be single, and they'd all look the same as they did in 1969.
Because that's the way life works.
That's right. So he called me up every day or so before the reunion. You know, what are you going to wear? What time are you going to get there? Who are you taking? Do you think this guy will be there? Do you think she'll be there? He also wanted to go to certain males in our class and kind of in your face, look how much money I have, which is understandable in some ways. He bought a new car. He took delivery on a new Mercedes the day before the reunion, just in case anybody saw him drive in or out. He bought a new suit for about $1,000. The morning of the reunion, he got a $400 haircut.
Wow.
From Beverly Hills. This is pocket change for this guy.
Wow.
And he came to this thing stag because he doesn't have any. And he had like a list of people he wanted to see, female and male from our class, girls he wanted to hit on, guys he wanted to hit on his own way, you
sure,
know,
sure,
yeah,
sure.
Show off, you know,
yeah.
Things like that. And people he just wanted to see for personal reasons, not just to lord it over. He had certain guys he just wanted to see because he just missed them and he wanted to see them again,
yeah,
and things
sure.
like that. So He gets the reunion. The reunion was held at the Hotel Miramar in Santa Monica.
Okay.
We're supposed to be there. The doors are opening at 7. The reunion starts at 8. He got there at 6:30. He was so eager. And
he's like setting up.
Yes. Anyway, so he goes up to they're still unpacking the sign-in sheets and the badges and things like that. And he goes up to the lady who's running the table, and he nags her into giving him his badge prematurely. She makes out a badge for him, and then he says, "Is Andy Fox going to be here?" And she looks at the list and goes, "No, he didn't. He's not coming." And he goes, "Oh, is Jennifer Kramer going to be here?" No, he looks at the list. She's not coming. Anyway, he gets really disappointed because he's got his own list of people he wants to see again.
Sure.
And none of them are coming. And he starts and then people start to drift into the reunion. And what strikes him is suddenly dawns on him how old everybody looks. Everybody's wandering around, and he's thinking to himself, "My God, I had crushes on these girls. These are like look like my mother. Look how old they are." And the guys are all bald and fat. And look, am I that age? Oh, my God. And he's wandering around, and he goes up to a couple people and says, "Remember me in physiology class?" No, they don't remember him. And he goes back to the lady, and he says, "Oh, is Jeff Finster going to come?" And she says, "No, he didn't RSVP." And he's just crushed. Nobody from the class he wanted to see is showing up.
Oh, cool.
Nobody who's there already remembers him at all. They all look so old. They all look so fat and things like that. He thinks, I wasted my time. I'm stupid. He walks out of the reunion. He decides to leave. He's not going to stay for the reunion. He's not going to stay for the dinner he paid for or anything like that. And he's walking out. He's going through the parking lot, heading back to the new Mercedes, feeling stupid and such. And I'm walking, and I was with Jewel, my friend Jewel Shepherd. Mm-hmm. I took Jewel to the thing. And he goes, "Oh, Evanier, oh, don't go in. It's terrible. The reunion, it's just everybody's so old, and none of our friends show up. Andy's not showing up, and Chuck's not showing up, and Linda's not coming," and all, And I go, "Well, gee, it sounds, I got to go in for at least a little while, and there'll be a few people that I know." He goes, "Nobody knows is going to be there. I looked at the list. Nobody's going to be there." I said, "Well, we'll go in for a little while. Which way is it here?" He says, "Oh, it's over here." I go, no, it's the Corinthian Ballroom. It's that way." He was in the wrong reunion.
Oh, my God.
He had.
Oh, my gosh.
We were uni high class of 69. He was in Pali high class of 59.
Of course he didn't know anybody.
Or 61 or something like that. Whatever it was, he was in the wrong reunion.
And a decade off.
A decade off, yeah. He was like more than 12 years off. He was more than 10 years off, I think. So we take him to the right reunion. We walk in. As we walk in, they're playing The Letter by the Box Tops.
Okay.
And he goes, "Oh, yeah, they were playing Yakety Yak by the Coasters in the other reunion."
Hello.
That should have been. And we walk in. And now, of course, all the girls look young to him.
Mm-hmm.
And there's Andy Fox. And there's Chuck Hartman.
Everybody
and there's all
he
the everybody he knew.
See.
They're all there only because of that. Because
he went the wrong way and didn't read his
invitation. Yeah. He went to the wrong ballroom.
He
had walked in and he said to somebody at the desk, where's the reunion? They went, "Oh, that it's down there."
Yeah.
And they told him. And
the real victim of this story is the poor woman he kept bothering about who was coming to the damn reunion, right?
So he had a good time. So
that's good.
Yeah. So we talked about your dad a minute ago.
Yes.
I want to talk about something you did to your mom in the car. Now, we all know you're friends with Gary Owens.
Yes. Oh, yes. Gary Owens.
So can you talk about Gary for a minute and tell the people at home, because there are some people who might,
Gary,
I don't know
how. Gary Owens is one of the nicest men in the world.
Yes,
you all know him as the announcer on Laugh-In, Rona Martin's Laugh-In. He was the voice of Space Ghost. He was the voice of Roger Ramjet.
Mm-hmm.
He was for many years, and he's kind of semi-retired now. He was the most heard voice on TV, doing network promos and announcing commercials and cartoons and everything. And he was on a radio station locally. He was on KMPC radio for about 20 years, I think, doing a wonderful show. I met Gary in 1970 and started writing jokes for his radio show. Back then, we became friends, and I worked with him a bunch of times. Just a lovely man.
Mm-hmm.
So one day, a couple of years ago, he did a period of time. He was on KGIL radio here in the Valley. And nowadays, he used to do his show live. And nowadays, most radio, when you have personalities, unless it's a call-in show, if it's just a music show, they usually just go in, tape all the intros and outros, and go home.
Mm.
So when we heard Gary's radio show on KGIL, he was not at the studio. He recorded that a couple of days earlier. That way he doesn't have to sit through the records. They just he does the intro, he does the outro, they edit them all in. So I put the radio station on because he was playing oldies. KGL was not even oldies. It was like a 40s blues, Sinatra, easy listening stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I thought my mother would appreciate it. So I had it on, and Gary's on the stove talking. And she's listening to this in my car as we're driving someplace. And then I get a call while we're driving along from Gary. He phones me, and I push the button to switch over. And my mother didn't notice this. She didn't hear the phone ring.
Had him on Bluetooth.
So I had him on, so his voice is coming out of the exact same speaker that it was coming out of when we listened to the radio show. And my mother looks over, and all of a sudden, I'm conversing with the radio. And the voice that's coming out of the radio is saying, "So, Mark, are you going to be going to the? You're going to the convention. You're going to be doing a couple panels there." And I said, "Yeah, I'm going to do. I think about 8 panels at the convention." And my mother's looking at me, going, "What's going on here? How did you get this radio? This amazing radio that you can talk to the man on the radio."
Thank you for calling Two-Way Radio. This is Gary Owens.
Because Gary sounds just the same way when he talks to you normally,
yeah.
as he does on the radio. He's got that incredible voice. Yeah. I always felt I always had this theory that if you could call Gary at like 4 in the morning, he'd answer the phone. Hello.
Hello. Yes.
Yeah, I had a sound engineer tell me a story about Gary Owens once, and literally called him a bastard, because he had come in and done a couple second spot for whatever company he was doing advertising for, television and radio ads. He just did a very quick tag, and it was going to be played so big and so broad that one 15 second session or whatever he had, he was going to make $45,000. Oh, and he was literally in the booth for less than 2 minutes.
Yeah.
And the guy said, "That SOB." Was it you that told me this story?
I told
you
this story.
Oh, yes. My God. You know what? Yes. Let me just lead you into it.
You're now telling me. That's
because I'm not telling it right.
You told it exactly right. That's the story.
Let me tell you.
You've told it. It's the only time I've ever heard anybody say anything nasty about Gary.
Yeah.
I'll tell you a nice Gary Owens story.
Yes.
I produced a special for CBS. This is mid-80s. It was a variety show. It was a primetime special previewing of the new Saturday morning schedule. And our cast was, now here's the cast we had. We had Cyndi Lauper, Pee-wee Herman, Hervé Villechaize, Patti LaBelle, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, New Edition, Hulk Hogan, Rowdy Roddy Piper, and Captain Lou Albano.
You had the whole 80s there.
Yeah.
Okay, we had wrestlers and rock stars and Captain and Hervé Villechaize.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And who's Hervé Villechaize?
Hervé Villechaize was the little dwarf on Fantasy Island.
The plane.
Oh, right. And his tattoo.
Yes, right, yes.
Yes, and little
people. And as an aside here, Hervé Villechaize, who has since left us, unfortunately, Hervé had about 4 wardrobe changes in this show. And
what was he wearing?
Well, he was wearing a tuxedo in one outfit.
Yeah.
And
was it white or was it black?
It was black.
It should have been white. Didn't he always wear white on Fantasy Island?
No, that was Mr. Rourke who did that. Anyway.
What else was he wearing?
I've got a great Ricardo Montalban story, too.
I will ask you about it in a minute.
All right. So Hervé had this condition.
Have him dressed as a luchador any point in the show?
Hervé, believe it or not, Hervé used to ink comic books. Hervé Villechaize was an inker for Harvey Comics.
What? Oh, really?
In the late 60s,
seriously?
Early 70s. And he developed he was an assistant to one of the regular inkers. He developed a condition in his hands, which I guess is not uncommon in dwarfs, where he couldn't grip anything anymore. He lost his career as a comic book inker because he couldn't grip anything. And when he was working with us on the show, he could not zip up his fly.
Awesome.
Because he couldn't hold the zipper.
Sure.
So he would come out, every time he had a wardrobe change, and we went through a lot of rehearsals, we had a bunch of wardrobe changes, he would come out with his fly unzipped, and he'd be running around looking for a wardrobe lady to zip him up.
And
the wardrobe women came to me and they said, "We don't want to do that.
Uh-huh.
We will not do that. We will not zip him up. That's not in the. You will complain to the union if you make us zip him up." So I went to the stage manager, and I said, "What is your title on this show?" And he said, "I'm the stage manager." I said, "Ah, I'm giving you a promotion. You are now a hyphenate. You are the stage manager - dwarf trouser adjuster."
Nice.
And yes. And he had to do that. And when people ask me, what does a producer do? I tell them that story.
Because it's true.
That's what a producer does. He makes those kinds of important decisions.
Chicken wrangler, all that stuff. Right. Yeah, so, absolutely.
So we had all these bizarre people on the show, and I thought
Wait, I asked you a question, and you ignored me, probably because it was a rude question, but I'm going to ask it again because I can't stop thinking about it. Right. Was he dressed as a luchador at any point in the show?
No.
Damn it.
Anyway, so... Right. So I thought, so we had all these bizarre people on the show.
He was in my mind.
Okay,
go ahead.
I mean, we had Kareem Abdul-Jabbar who was in a... 90...
Was he dressed as a luchador?
No.
Damn it!
This was before luchadors. It was WWF.
All right. Vince, the executive producer of this show...
Was a luchador.
No!
All right, I'll stop.
No, you won't.
No, I won't. Executive producer
was a man named Vince McMahon, who was the head of what was then WWF. It's no longer WWF.
Okay. He's the honchador.
He was the executive.
Yeah.
And at one point, I was trying to make conversation with just small talk.
Yeah.
And they had just done a scenario. That's what they call them, the scenarios, where Hulk Hogan was rescued when someone was beating the crap out of him in the ring one event at some WrestleMania, whatever it was.
Smackdown.
And Mr. T came running in and out of nowhere, and started hitting, picked up a folding chair and started hitting the other wrestler with a folding chair.
That was Piper and Paul Orndorff.
Which, by the way...
Did you hear that?
What?
It was Piper and Paul Orndorff.
See, he knows that. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Which I think is very interesting, which is that, like if you're in the ring in the WWF, for another guy to come running out of the audience and start beating up your opponent is not against the rules.
I know, right? You
pick up a metal folding chair and start hitting the guy over the head. That is not a rule violation of the rules.
As long as his Q rating is at least yours or above.
So I said to Vince McMahon, trying to make conversation, bond with this guy a little bit and show him that I had watched the wrestling stuff. And I'm producer and head. I was the producer-writer of this show. I said, so how'd you get Mr. T to do that? And Vince McMahon looked at me like I was the stupidest human being on the face of this planet.
Oh.
And he said to me, in the tone you would use to lecture a very, very stupid 8-year-old, he said, in the history of professional wrestling, no one has ever done anything for any reason except money.
Wow.
And I went, oh, and I thought, that's a good thing to know.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So, anyway.
Wow.
So, and I found out that there was a slight exception to that. We could not have Hulk Hogan and Rowdy Roddy Piper in the studio at the same time.
Why?
They hated each other.
Oh.
That was why, because Piper was the one who double-teamed him with Paul Orndorff.
Yeah. But it wasn't because of that. It was like a professional rivalry. It's just, the way, some people can't have Paul and me in the same panel because we hate each other much as writers.
Just so that those of you know at home, we actually had to build a brick wall between them. It sounds like they're next to each other, but they can't, when they reach out in between, you can't hear it, but they actually punch sideways because they know one another's on the side of the brick wall.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so they're really just scuffing up their knuckles. Ezra's got it muted, so you can't hear it.
So there is an emotional side to that business, but the point is those guys are there. They're, whatever they do, they're doing because they're getting paid.
Yeah.
Anyway, so... we had this show we're doing, and I felt with all these bizarre people on it, we needed somebody normal, so I cast Gary Owens on it.
Nice.
And we made him the announcer and sidekick on the thing, and he was on a bunch of things. We did this one thing where we had Gary interviewing Hulk Hogan in a segment in a locker room,
mm-hmm.
and we had Hulk for 2 hours. He was flying from some place to another to do a wrestling match.
He was a huge star.
And and we only had him for 2 hours. And he would walk on the set at 12, and he would walk off at 2, and that was it. So he gets there, and we needed to oil him up. And that had to be done by a union makeup person. And he wouldn't let the male union makeup person oil him up, so we had to wait for a female makeup person to arrive to oil Hulk, and then we taped this thing. And
now it's 1:15. You got him for 45 more minutes.
So we basically did like 2 takes with him, and he left. So we had not shot Gary's close-ups, which would have been over Hulk's shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
So they put me on an Apple box.
Yeah, they did.
I'm six 6'3", but to get me to Hulk Hogan's height, I had to stand on a box.
Mm-hmm.
And I took my shirt off, and they put makeup on my shoulder, and I tried to hold it up so it looked like kind of his shoulder.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and they shot the close up of Gary asking his questions over my shoulder, and a little bit of my shoulder was that I stunt doubled Hulk Hogan's shoulder.
Yeah, you did.
So anyway, so
that's spectacular.
Awesome. You should have had you rip the shirt off
that's
from
right.
behind.
Yeah. Anyway, so anyway,
and you were dressed as a luchador.
So now we had a live audience.
This is not even acknowledging me anymore.
No, we had a live audience for the main part of the taping. The Hulk Hogan thing was taped earlier in the day. But for the main part of the tape, we had a live audience there.
I think if you were a luchador, you would have like a Captain America mask.
Are you being obnoxious on purpose?
Yeah, I will. Okay. All right, so you had a live audience. I'll stop. That's the last luchador question.
Okay, good.
For now.
So, we had a live audience in, and I'd made a mistake. You make mistakes in this world. I'd forgotten to hire an audience warm-up person.
Uh-oh.
And I realized it at kind of the night before, and I thought, well, let's have Gary do it. We'll pay him extra.
Oh, yeah, has he done that before? Had he ever done stand-up?
Well, Gary, he's been a host and announcing. He's done warm-ups for years for TV shows and game shows and things like that. I mean, he was the absolute perfect. Why hire somebody else? We have the absolute perfect person there. Well, the problem was we had told Gary that he could leave at 7 o'clock. And he had booked a voiceover session that evening for a commercial.
Okay.
In fact, they wanted him during the day, but he was doing our show, so they said they'd take him at night. So I went to Gary and I said to him, we'd like you to do the warm-up. We'll pay you the extra fee for that. He goes, I don't need the extra fee. No, we have to pay it. We're going to pay it to somebody. We'll pay it to you.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd like you to do the warm-up. And he said, well, I have to leave at 7 because I'm committed to do this other commercial. I said, fine, that's fine. We'll be done by then. Well, as happens frequently on taping, we weren't anywhere near done as we're getting to 7.
No.
We were way behind. We hadn't shot the end of the show. We were, and so the idea, so I went to Gary and I said, look, you'll have to leave at 7. I'll take over hosting the audience after that. He'd already been, with the audience for 3 hours or so at that point.
Oh my gosh.
Mm-hmm. And the audience was actually having a good time. It was a fun
he's
show
good
to watch.
At that.
He was very good in the end. And Roddy Piper was running out yelling at people and stuff like that.
Nice.
Pee Wee Herman was working the audience. Anyway, so Paul Rubens, I should call him. Anyway, so
yeah,
well, he likes being. He is Paul Rubens. Yes. I mean, and I knew him as Paul Rubens before he was Pee Wee Herman.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
So anyway, so I went to Gary and he said, "Oh no, I saw that you guys were not going to be able to finish in time." So I got the session moved to another day. I can stay as late as you want me to.
Nice.
So he stayed like till 10 o'clock that night.
Mm-hmm.
And
he had been there since
very,
what time in the morning?
He'd
Eight?
Been there since about noon,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah. Wow.
And he stayed. And he was wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
The next day or days later, I'm booking voice actors or something. And I called an agent who was Gary's voiceover agent. And he said, oh, we're really mad at you. And I said, what did I do now? He said, well, you kept Gary so long that he blew off that other session. He didn't do the other session. He was fibbing to me. He didn't move it. He just had them get somebody else.
No.
And I said, okay, how much did he lose by staying doing my show? And the guy said, oh, about $30,000.
Holy shit.
Wow.
And now here's the thing that's interesting about that story. There's lots of people in this business who will do you a favor. They make sure you know about it,
mm-hmm.
so that someday you'll owe them a favor. Gary didn't tell me that he'd done that.
Yeah,
he went ahead and he killed a $30,000 job to stay. Now, to give this in perspective, Gary is a very smart man, and he was well aware that his career had a lot to do with the fact that he was on camera and Rona Martin's laughing. And he liked doing our show because it paid off. We put him on camera. We had an on-camera role. We treated him. We identified him by name a couple of times. Mm-hmm. We talked about it. We let him play straight man for Hulk Hogan and things like that. So there was a value to him doing our show.
Mm-hmm.
But not $30,000.
I know, right?
So,
yeah.
Anyway, so that's a nice story about Gary Owens.
Because Gary Owens is a nice guy.
Very nice man.
Oh, and speaking of that, that's how I know him from laughing, too. Nick at Night, when I was a kid, I watched and saw this guy doing the bits in between, doing the narrations, and
got to know him as Gary Owens and then identify him later on.
Yeah, very classy guy.
Got to meet him in person once. He was just very nice.
He's nice to everybody. Yeah. And some of that is guys who grew up in radio. I mean, he was in local radio for years and years and years, and you have to be nice to everybody because your life is dealing with sponsors. Mm-hmm. So you learn to, you know, everybody you meet, you learn to remember the name of their wife and their kids and their hobby and things like that. That's part of salesmanship. But Gary takes it to another level. And there's a lot of other guys who are in his same peers. Mm-hmm. At the time, Gary was the voice of all the comedy promos on ABC.
Yeah.
Ernie Anderson was the voice of all the non-comedy promos, and Ernie was not like Gary. Yeah. So, and would have been the first one to admit it. Ernie had no patience for that, being polite to people. He'd just come in, do the copy, and say, "Give me my check and leave." Mm-hmm. I directed him one time, and he was fairly nice for him. Mm-hmm. So,
well, this is part one. And I think I have so many more questions that we aren't even close to done. So I think we should do a Gary Owens sign out. Let's have a Gary Owens contest. Who wants to go first? Give me a Gary Owens.
We had Gary on Garfield. We had a Gary Owens sound-alike contest. We had Frank Welker, uh-huh. Greg Berger, and Neil Ross were also there. And we had them, and we had all four of them do a Gary Owens voice.
Yeah.
And we judged who sounded the most like Gary Owens, and I think Gary came in third.
Awesome.
You want to do the sign-out, Gary Owens sign-out, or should we all do one?
Well, let's do one individually.
Okay, go ahead.
This is Gary Owens with my sidekick, Morgo the Friendly Drelmb, wishing you a good evening.
What's Morgo the Friendly Drelmb?
I don't know.
Morgo the Friendly Drelmb was a running character gag on Laugh-In.
Okay.
You never saw it, whatever it was.
Okay.
They had Morgo on at one point, but Gary would always say, when he was doing billboarding the guests, he'd say, Artie Johnson and Judy Carn and Lily Tomlin, and Morgo is the Friendly Drelmb.
That's cute. Do you want to do a Gary Owens?
No.
Ezra, you want to do a Gary Owens?
Sure.
Wait, I want to hear Emily's first. No, decline.
I already do kind of one when I try to do the intros anyway. That's my model.
This is Radio Rashi, and you're listening to Gary Owens saying good night.
Okay, I'll do one too. This is Gary Owens saying thank you very much from Radio Rashi, with special thanks to our sponsors, the ZBQ Alphabet Course. We are not very good at what we teach. Good night, everybody.
Bye.
This has been another episode of Radio Rashi. If you've enjoyed this episode, let everyone know by leaving a review in the iTunes Store. It's a great way to help others find us. You can also leave comments on RadioRashi.com, Facebook.com/RadioRashi, or follow us on Twitter @RadioRashi or @Paul_Dini to leave us questions. Thanks for listening, and tell your friends.